This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman, and here are some of the stories making headlines around the world today. A car bomb exploded in a vegetable market in the border town of Ras Al Ain in northeast Syria, with reports of several killed and wounded, the Syrian state news agency reported on Saturday. There were no further details about casualties in the report, but residents told Reuters that two people were killed and several more wounded. India's federal territory of Jammu and Kashmir plans to attract investments worth up to $4 billion in the next 2 to 3 years and would provide security to businesses setting up shop in the insurgency-hit region. That's what its chief said on Saturday. Jammu and Kashmir was India's only Muslim-majority state until August of 2019, when Prime Minister Narendra Modi carved out a Buddhist-dominated enclave and designated both as federally administered territories. China's relationship with the United States has reached a new crossroads and could get back on track following a period of unprecedented difficulty. This is what senior diplomat Wang Yi said in official comments published on Saturday. Relations between the world's two biggest economies have come under increasing strain amid a series of disputes over trade, human rights, and the origins of COVID-19 even. In its latest move, the United States blacklisted dozens of Chinese companies it said had ties to the military. And Pakistan on Saturday arrested a man accused of being a leader of an Islamist militant group blamed by the United States and India for the 2008 Mumbai attacks. A counterterrorism official said the arrest is in relation to terrorism financing, the official said, and not a specific militant act. This is VOA News. Several hundred French police on Saturday shut down an illegal rave party in northwestern France. It had been underway since New Year's Eve in defiance of a curfew and coronavirus restrictions on large gatherings. About 2,500 partiers from across France and even abroad attended the rave in an empty warehouse in Brittany. Techno music had blared out during the night from the warehouses, which had been transformed into illegal nightclubs. The local prefecture said Saturday the music had been switched off and sound systems dismantled after two nights, and the first revelers began leaving the site before dawn. The French Interior Minister said police had booked more than 1,200 people and seized a truck, sound equipment, and generators from the site of the illegal rave party. And officials say that many of these partiers were not wearing masks and were using narcotics. The regional health authority in Brittany noted the high risk of the spread of COVID-19 at the event and called on those who went to undergo coronavirus tests and self-isolate immediately for 7 days. Congo said on Saturday that 14 suspected Islamist militants and two soldiers were killed in fighting on New Year's Day as the Congolese army, backed by UN peacekeepers, regained control of Luslus village in the east of the country. The Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, has carried out several attacks in recent weeks. It's a Ugandan Islamist group that has emerged as the most lethal of the militias in Democratic Republic of Congo's eastern borderlands. An army spokesman said that troops had overpowered the, quote, ADF terrorists in the village and dislodged them from the area. And the United Nations mission in Congo said it helped Congo's army regain control. A local official said on Friday that the ADF was responsible for the killing of 17 people who were found hacked to death in North Kivu. More than 1,000 civilians have been killed in attacks attributed to the ADF in 2019 and 2020, according to UN figures. The U.S. Congress has overridden President Donald Trump's veto of a defense policy bill. It's a first by lawmakers since Mr. Trump took office nearly 4 years ago. In an extraordinary New Year's Day session, the Republican-controlled Senate turned aside the veto, dismissing the president's objections to the $740 billion bill. President Trump rejected the defense measure last week, saying it failed to limit social media companies he claimed were biased against him during his failed reelection campaign. He also opposed the language that allows for the renaming of military bases honoring Confederate leaders.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Tried to be fair to all because we think that the right thing we should do as the Electoral Commission, but also where they have gone out, of course, there has been intervention by law enforcement agencies.
The Ugandan Electoral Commission finalizes plans to administer the January 14 polls.
The president is not above the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. The Federal Republic of Nigeria says citizens have the right to express their views, citizens have the right to protest, and not Buhari or anybody working with him can say otherwise.
Nigerian right activists condemned the arrest of Omoyele Sowore, a former presidential candidate, on the eve of the new year.
You know, so if we do not recognize this, and we think that it's only the political position that makes things change, no, it's the businesses that go behind the politics for that handshake to be done before things are changed.
Right.
Without which, nothing happens. So we need to find a way to resolve it, and it must be resolved.
And a prominent Ghanaian businessman calls for a speedy resolution of the recent election dispute. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Ugandan Electoral Commission is in the final stages of preparation ahead of the January 14 polls. Paul Bukenya, spokesperson for the electoral body, says the organization is monitoring the campaigns of all the political parties in the run-up to the elections. This after opposition groups accuse the Electoral Commission and the security agencies of bias. They also say the government is using state institutions, including the police and the military, to intimidate and harass opposition supporters before the elections. Both the government and the Electoral Commission deny the accusations as without merit. For the latest developments regarding the Commission's preparations for the upcoming polls, I reached its spokesperson Paul Bukenya in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Well, where we are right now, we're getting into the final phases of our preparations as the Commission. We have gotten the ballot papers into the country, and actually we started packing them into what we call the polling kit. The polling kit is the special metallic box which we take after the polling station, and it contains everything that's required for purposes of voting on polling day. So we've put into the kit the items, which include the register. We have now put in the ballot papers, and we've put in the generic materials that are used at polling stations, the ink, the pens that are used to tick, the materials that officers use on polling day, the solar lamps that help with the lighting at the polling station on polling day. And so that is a big step in terms of readiness for the elections on 14th. Of course, now what remains is to deliver these boxes to these materials to the districts, and then afterwards they will be distributed up to the polling stations on the day before polling on 14th. So we are moving well in that area. Also, the training of officials who will conduct the exercise, accreditation of observers, and of course the campaigns are continuing as we prepare for the elections.
Talking about transparency, are other stakeholders involved in the processes as the Electoral Commission prepares for the elections, in terms of it, the stakeholders' involvement in the process to ensure transparency and credibility of the polls?
Well, we've invited key stakeholders to be present. For example, when we are receiving the ballot papers, you know they were printed out of the country. So when they brought in at the airport, we have had observers from political parties and representatives of the candidates who are participating in this election. And that helps us to ensure that there is an eye watching what's going on, and the activities are observed. Then also, when the materials are delivered at the warehouse, we've had the observers from those stakeholders coming in. But also when we started packing items into the boxes, we publicized it and had the observers around. So we're also accrediting more observers, because the list of observers, of course, includes international and the regional bodies. So that one is ongoing. So we believe that Where we are so far, the processes are being observed, but more so, the polling processes will be observed by even more eyes, including regional and other international organizations and institutions and diplomatic missions which are based in Uganda.
So far, how has the campaign gone? And is the Electoral Commission monitoring activities of each political campaign in the run-up to the elections?
The campaigns have been progressing. We have our various categories of candidates. Candidates at local government level, they are campaigning. Our candidates at parliamentary level, they are also campaigning, as well as presidential candidates. We've not had much in terms of challenges with the other elective positions, other than the incidents we've seen involving our campaigns organized by some of the presidential candidates. So for that matter, and because of the COVID-19 environment and the restrictions that we put up to limit the number of people who can come for meetings, we had to suspend physical meetings in some of the districts where the risk is very high and where there is very, very high population. So we are trying to manage that, as well as address, you know, other emerging issues like, you know, non-compliance with our standard operating procedures, which on many occasions has brought in actions of or intervention of law enforcement, leading to some confrontations that look rather ugly. So campaigns are going on, and we are addressing emerging issues within our, you know, ability and to manage and prevent the spread of COVID-19. But as it is, candidates have had the opportunity to reach out to the voters, and by now we know that for sure the population knows the candidates who are participating in the elections at presidential level, and then they're also mobilizing to get ready for voting on the 14th of January, which is just now a few days away.
Now, Paul, I'm sure you are aware of some opposition groups, including the NUP led by Bobi Wine, as well as the FDC led by Patrick Oboye-Amory, at expressing concern that it appears that the Electoral Commission is biased and in favor of the ruling National Resistance Movement, and that their campaigns have been hampered by security under the guise of using COVID-19 protocols to suppress them, while the NRM campaigns are allowed to proceed despite the imposed guidelines to stop the spread of the disease. How do you respond to such criticism?
We think we've been fair to all parties involved. We give the same guidelines, and we've seen that there's been an effort to comply. There are 11 presidential candidates in this race, and some number of them have not really gotten any issues involving or leading to confrontations, except perhaps what we've seen mainly involving candidate Patrick Amuriat Oboy and candidate Chagulanyi Robert, or also commonly known as Bobi Wine. We brought these matters to their attention that you need to comply with the standard operating procedures. Otherwise, they are putting the population at risk and also themselves as candidates, the risk of getting COVID-19. So I think we've been fair, we've given audience to all sides. But at the same time, also NRM, where the supporters of NRM who have not complied with this have also been called to order. We've not suspended the campaigns of anyone as a result of this, other than because even in the areas where we have suspended physical campaigns, other forms of campaigns, including open-air broadcasting, posters, banners, radio, and other forms of communication, even one-on-one, has continued. So I think we've tried to be fair to all, because we think that the right thing we should do as the Electoral Commission, but also where they have gone out, of course, there has been intervention by law enforcement agencies. And I think the two have been having the most, you know, such incidences.
Paul Bukenya is the spokesperson for the Electoral Commission of Uganda. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The convener of Concern Nigeria, a pro-democracy group, is condemning the latest arrest of rights activist Omoyele Sowore. Deji Adeyanju says the latest arrest is yet another indication of the government's disregard of the constitution, which guarantees freedom of assembly and expression. Sowore, a former presidential candidate, was arrested on the eve of the new year. This after leading a protest to demand for good governance in the capital Abuja Thursday. Local media reports several activists were also arrested during the protest. Deji Adeyanju tells me that it appears the government treats bandits, terrorists and kidnappers better than lawful Nigerians carrying out their constitutional right to protest.
It's unthinkable that in a country where government is negotiating with bandits, terrorist groups, and even with the allegations everywhere that they are paying ransom, you know, to terrorists, and the friendly romance and emotional hugs and kisses that Buhari showers on bandits and terrorist groups, you know, it is laughable that the same man, you know, has now successfully criminalized freedom of assembly in the country, you know, and freedom of speech is gradually eluding the citizenry, you know, and, you know, every right-thinking Nigerian must condemn, you know, this onslaught against our constitutional democracy, you know, and, you know, the irreducible minimum, like I always say in a democracy, is that the freedom to protest, the freedom to speak, for citizens to speak their mind freely, you know, must be guaranteed. You know, and this is why, as a group, as Sowore is not just my friend and compatriot, Sowore is a patriot, you know, and as a group, we condemn this in its entirety, and we say that the president, you know, must turn a new leaf in the new year. The president must decriminalize freedom of assembly and that of speech, you know, that we do not want a repeat of what happened in 2020 to happen in 2021, you know, so we condemn this arrest in its entirety and call for his immediate and unconditional release. Thank you.
But Deji, he was recently arrested, served over 100 days in detention for similar protests. Why undertake another protest? Some people are asking. What do you say to that?
Where in the world has protest become a crime? The Boko Haram members that Buhari is negotiating with, the bandits that they're negotiating with, they have kidnapped people in the past. Why are they also undertaking to kidnap more people, and Buhari is undertaking to pay more people fresh ransom to them, or Buhari is undertaking to negotiate and discuss with them? You know, protest can never be a crime in a democracy. Even, you know, even under military dictatorship, protest is not a crime. You know, so, you know, we should bury the thoughts that people will bow to Buhari because Buhari wants to cow the citizens, and that the citizens because Sowore was arrested, therefore Sowore should be trembling and not have the guts or courage to protest. So that can never be tolerated in a democracy.
But Deji, critics of Sowore say that this is yet another attempt to create disaffection, create instability in the country, particularly when he has been accused and still faces charges of attempting to overthrow the government. So this, they argue, is unwise for him to undertake at this critical moment when the government is trying to put things together, they argue. What do you say to that?
Brother, there is no sign that anything is working in this country. There is no sign that anything is working. So what are we talking about here? You know, which disaffection? There is banditry, there's insecurity all over the country, you know, there's maladministration in the country, you know, the government is in disarray, this is a government that negotiates with bandits here and there. So what are we really talking about, please? Who are these people? You know, is it the bandits that the government is negotiating with? Are they the critics of Sowore? You know, so let us put things in proper perspective. You know, President Buhari is on the wrong side of history here. You know, this is somebody that opened fire on innocent Shiites in Zaria, killing almost 1,000, fired live ammunition at protesters in Lekki, you know, and several other places, has been arresting protesters, arrested Sowore, rearrested him now. So what are we talking about here, please? Thank you.
So what is the next line of action for those of you who are friends, activists with him? What are you going to do about his current situation? Because his critics say it serves him right in the position he has put himself in.
All Nigerians must keep demanding. All Nigerians must keep criticizing. All Nigerians must keep protesting
It's a fundamentally guaranteed right. Buhari does not have any power to determine what Nigerians say, do, or anything. Buhari is no more Nigerian than every other Nigerian, whether those criticizing him or those hailing him. The president is not above the constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. The Federal Republic of Nigeria says citizens have the right to express their views, citizens have the right to protest, and not Buhari or anybody working with him can say otherwise.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener of Concerned Nigeria, a pro-democracy group. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. A girls' education rights group, the Malala Fund, says the majority of Nigeria's out-of-school children during the pandemic are girls and that the gap with boys is widening. For VOA, Ifeok Etang reports from Jos, Nigeria.
13-year-old Joy Pam has had to wash the plates, cook the family meals, and sweep the compound daily since the pandemic forced schools to shut down in March. Even though schools have reopened now, she still must continue with her chores at home, even though her classmates are back at school.
When I see them going to school, tears will start dropping out from my eyes. I wish my parents could get the money and pay my school fees to go back to school because I want to go back to school and study.
The Malala Fund is a non-profit education rights group that advocates for girls' education around the world. Its Nigerian representative, Crystal Ikani Musa, says Nigeria has more girls out of school than boys, especially in the north.
Before the COVID pandemic, Nigeria had 13.2 million children out of school. Over 50% of that number are girls. Once the pandemic hit, up to way more than that, about 36 million children were out of school.
Education officials such as Matthew Sule, the executive chairman of the Plateau State Universal Basic Education Board, says girls face more obstacles in gaining access to education.
Assistance should be given to the children, particularly also the girl child. We have had radio and television broadcasts. We have produced some hard copied material which have delivered to the children at home.
Research spearheaded by the Malala Fund's Ikani Musa indicates that during the lockdown, many girls face hurdles to being able to use government-provided distant learning options.
Girls are in rural areas. A lot of them did not have access to television or radio because they don't have electricity. There are also cultural and social norm factors where these girls are not able to have access to data. So in a typical family, the girl may have to ask a parent or her spouse to use a smartphone where she could have accessed some of these materials. And depending on if they were granted permission, they were able to access these alternative learning options.
Girls also spent more time doing household chores, according to Malala Fund champion and CEO of Connected Development, Hamzat Lawal.
We saw from data, and data we collected directly from children with consent from their parents, that a lot of girls got more hours to do house chores, while boys got plenty hours to play. So what this also means is the girls had less hours to study and prepare for school reopening.
The Universal Basic Education Act of 2004 offers free education for every Nigerian child from primary to junior secondary school. But Hamzat Lawal, the CEO of Connected Development and Malala Fund champion, says there are hidden fees that many poor families can't afford.
Our campaign is saying remove hidden fee, amend the Universal Basic Education Act, and ensure compulsorily that girls and boys, particularly girls, go to school and access free 12-year education.
The state's Universal Basic Education Board is calling on development partners to help fund education for children in rural communities. Ifeok Etang for VOA News, Jos, Nigeria.
The founder and executive chairman of Celtel Networks, Dr. Prince Kofi Kluijesing, is calling for a quick resolution of a dispute over the recent Ghanaian elections. Dr. Kluijesing warns that if not speedily addressed, the dispute will have an adverse effect on business. His remarks come after main challenger former President John Dramani Mahama and his National Democratic Congress, or NDC, disputed the outcome of the December 7 elections. Citing voter irregularities, the party has rejected the result of the presidential poll while challenging some of the parliamentary poll outcome. They also accused the Electoral Commission of bias, an accusation the electoral body denies. For analysis on the impact of the elections dispute on business activities, I sat down with Dr. Kluijesing, founder and executive chairman of Celtel Networks.
Ghana has been a royal country, you know, so there is one to be called elders, you know, who always step in if there's any issues. But it seems to me that the politics has completely overweighed those important culture of Ghana. So it goes and have a major impact on business and all our social sector. You see, those who are really championing the politics think that it's only a politics issue, but it affects all the socioeconomic situations of Ghana and all the businesses. You know, because the issue that are going on right now, that most people can tell you are calling their principals, are calling their people in Ghana, what's your expectations? Banks will hold on to credit. The shipments will be held on. Nobody knows what's going to happen, so forth and so good. So these are things that really bothers me, you know, at this point in time. But being, an optimist, you know, who believe in positive mental attitude as well, I am positive that somewhere down the line there will be a resolution as to what the issues are.
What is the best way forward to address some of these challenges and disputes as a result of the outcome of this election?
When you look at Ghana as well, John Mahama, President John Mahama, Vice President Bawumia, President Akufo-Addo, they are a family as far as I'm concerned, you know. Mm-hmm. I say this because, you know, they're all children of past, you know, prominent politicians today. Mm-hmm. So I don't see a lot of enmity, you know, among them, as far as I know it. Mm-hmm. So I would have thought that maybe some between themselves, you know, somebody would have moved in. Right. But I believe that we need to come up, you know, those of us who are opinion leaders, I think we need to come on and step in and find out what exactly the issues are, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, it's not the end of the world, as far as I'm concerned. But I presume that, for a business not to be affected, all these programs not to be affected, the donors and others will not step back. You know, I believe that there must be some kind of intervention.
As a businessman and a technologist, if this thing is not resolved amicably, some people express concern that it could raise its ugly head, it could come out in different forms if they are not resolved. Do you have a concern that it could affect businesses like yours and other businesses in the country?
Of course. You see, people think it's a politics. But politics is business. You see, you know, you cannot do politics without business. You mm-hmm. see, you know, business, politics is backed by business. You see, so if you don't resolve it very quickly, all these programs, you know, that are in the offing will be damaged. You know, will be damaged. So I believe that it has to be done. We have to find a way to deal with it.
Who want to come and invest in Ghana? Sometimes you have people in the West, even Africa, who wants to come and invest in Ghana because they think the country is stable, it's peaceful, there has always been a smooth transfer of power. Talk to me about the dynamics if this is not resolved.
Ghana is becoming like the center of Africa in right. terms of investment destination. Everybody wants to have an office in Ghana, everybody wants to stay in Ghana and live in Ghana. And operate in Africa. In my area, like the business I'm doing all the major companies like Cisco, mm-hmm. like Facebook, like Hughes, major technology companies. I've been a leader of technology in Ghana from HP, from mm-hmm. AT&T. Through my first, we managed to bring the policy of NCA, mm-hmm. stock exchange through AT&T coming to Ghana, the media commissions. Mm-hmm. So it is through business that policies changed.
Right.
You know, so if we do not recognize this, and we think that it's only the political position that makes things change. No, it's the businesses that go behind the politics mm-hmm. for that handshake to be done before things are changed.
Right.
Without which nothing happens. So we need to find a way to resolve it, and it must be resolved.
Dr. Prince Kofi Kluijesing is the founder and executive chairman of Celtel Networks. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the U.S. government has passed a law that grants expansive new rights to refugees fleeing persecution and hardship in neighboring countries. The new legislation is being hailed by national and international human rights and refugee aid groups, including the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. For more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with the commission spokeswoman and operations assistant, Roberta Montevecchi.
It's a major step forward to the country and to the region in general. Chad was the only country in the Western Africa without an asylum law.
How are refugees able to be granted asylum in Chad now? I understand there are two main ways.
Yes, one is to group refugees, which is generally the case, for example, of the Sudanese refugee and refugees that came from the Central African Republic in the past and Nigeria.
When you say a group, do you mean people from one place or people who actually cross the borders physically together into Chad?
The Refugee Convention of 1951 has to have a personal persecution story, while the African Convention speaks more about massive displacement of population across border and massive violation of human rights. So if you belong to that group, you can then be recognized as a refugee. So it's very generous. That's typical in African context.
Other things in which the law of Chad is much more generous is, for example, when it comes to the family reunification principle. Imagine in your country, my country, it will be generally limited to the nuclear family, while in Chad is extending to the extended families, which is more, I would say, fit into the African context.
What's the second major aspect of the new law?
The second part is that it provides freedom of movement of refugees, and it provides access to healthcare like a right, not just as an entitlement that can happen or not happen, and rights for education, rights to work legally, access to justice, and then family reunification also in a very broad sense. So it's really very good law at the international level and at the regional level.
Why did this law come to pass and why now?
One key moment was the Global Refugee Forum in 2019 when Chad was among the African countries that pledged for improving the legal, physical, material protection of refugees. That was most likely a trigger. And the fact that Chad was maybe the only remaining country in the Central and West Africa without an asylum law, and that is the root of these latest changes. So the law is coming to put an end to a legal vacuum. Well, I have to say that Chad is recognized to be a country with, I would say, legendary hospitality. And you know, now approximately 3% of the population of Chad is made of refugees and displaced people. So in that sense, it's really doing great. I mean, it's exemplary.
Tell me, where do most of these refugees come from?
The majority of refugees, approximately 375,000 refugees that are now in Chad, come from Sudan. Then the second biggest group, close to 97,000, are people coming from Central African Republic. And then the last group, Nigerian refugees, about 17,000.
Do these refugees go to camps mostly?
Yes. Majority of refugees now are still in the camps, but then more and more the approach that UNHCR is advocating is breaking the boundaries between the camps and the surrounding villages in order then to be sure that whatever assistance you give to refugees will also benefit the local population. Give you an example. We built in the past health center that were under a refugee program. But now the health center are basically transferred to the ownership of the Chadian government, and the international community is supporting this health center that provide health care to refugees and to the locals, already in a share of 60 to 40%.
This sounds like possibly a more peaceful solution in the long term. As you know, there's often competition and outright conflict between refugees and the local population of the places where they settle. It's certainly true in the U.S., where some people really resent refugees, thinking that refugees take more than their fair share of government resources and jobs.
Yes. So another example we are working on is for the vocational training. So to transfer whatever vocational training center we built to the government and then help the government to make the utmost of this center and to run them. Of course, maybe you need to help them still for some years to come, but that is broadening the access to refugees and host communities. And in that way, you will also prevent or mitigate conflict and to build on synergies rather than divide.
Many South Africans have described 2020 as a lost year. Most of them spent two quarters of the year under lockdown with no income. Many companies, especially in the food industry, either closed completely or only partially reopened. For VOA, Thusa Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
A year of sickness, burials and poverty. This is how many South Africans have described the year 2020. Others say it's the worst year in the country's history, including those years spent under apartheid. On the health front, over 1 million people were infected by the coronavirus in 2020. COVID-19-related deaths are nearing 30,000. On the economic front, tens of thousands were left jobless. Many of those who were able to remain in their jobs had their wages reduced to enable their companies to stay afloat. Johannesburg resident Stella Mazu says there are no words to describe the devastation experienced in 2020.
2020 has been a very painful year. We started this year happy, having so many plans that never came to avail. We've lost so many friends, so many families. We've lost our jobs, our source of incomes. As we face 2021, we're facing it with so much uncertainty.
And Imtiaz Suleiman, the founder of The Givers, a South African-based international humanitarian organization, says the humanitarian crisis experienced in 2020 was the first of its kind.
COVID-19, its challenges, the hopes, the difficulty, the depression, the sadness, the job losses, the anxiety of medical professionals, families affected, and people, who are in good standing, losing their jobs, losing everything overnight after the lockdown.
Many say long periods of lockdown made all aspects of life harder. Lita Vuge, a student at the University of Johannesburg, says 2020 was the most difficult year for students.
Definitely, I describe 2020 as a challenging year, terrifying year. It meant hard to navigate through academic year. Teachers had challenges. How do we continue and save the academic year amidst the pandemic? It's been scary. It's been traumatizing. It's been everything bad you can think of.
Athletes and artists were not spared. André Leroux is the founder of the IKS Africa, a live concert promotion company.
It was devastating. By the end of March, all the South African tours were cancelled. The last gigs for many artists was December last year. And now, March, April, May, June, July, August, people haven't been performing. We were devastated. We got calls. At one stage, I was arranging food parcels for artists.
For many South Africans, it's a year they will want to quickly forget. Some wish it could be deleted from the calendar, while others want it declared a year that was never lived. Thuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Members of the new ethnic Shona community in Kenya are celebrating their new status as Kenyan citizens after decades of being stateless. For VOA, Brenda Mulinya takes a look at what this new legal status means for the Shona.
Nazizi Dube gazes at what is now her most prized possession, a document declaring her a citizen of Kenya. Dube is one of almost 1,700 ethnic Shona and 1,300 ethnic Rwandans who gained legal status this month after decades of being stateless. On December 12th, as Kenya marked its 57th independence anniversary, Nazizi and other members of the Shona community in Kenya were recognized as citizens following a decree by the country's president, Uhuru Kenyatta.
All the challenges that we went through with the statelessness status, we were very excited knowing that all has come to an end. It was a new beginning.
a beginning that they hope will open new opportunities. Diana Gishengo of the Kenya Human Rights Commission says that decades of statelessness left the community marginalized.
They were stateless. All their rights were violated. Their freedom of movement was violated. They couldn't leave the country. The few who finally managed to travel had to acquire fake or irregular identities to travel. They couldn't access education.
Ishmael Dlamini has run his carpentry workshop just outside the capital, Nairobi, for nearly 20 years without identification documents. As a Shona, his earnings were limited because he could not use banks or borrow the way Kenyan citizens can. That has changed. Dlamini says we will have the certificate of citizenship. He says it will enable me to go to a bank or any other lending institution and get a loan to allow me to do more business. The Shona began arriving in Kenya in the 1930s, primarily from what is now Zimbabwe, and more came in the early 1960s as missionaries. But when Kenya became independent from the British in 1963, most missed the two-year window to become citizens along with their children born in the country. The push to have them recognized as Kenyans escalated over the past 4 years. Wanja Munaita with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees welcomes the decision to grant the Shona citizenship.
Legal identity is really important, and especially now that Kenya is going into the digital identity, because then they would have been left out of that system, because then they didn't have any document.
Gishengo of the Kenya Human Rights Commission, which was involved in the campaign to end statelessness, says more needs to be done to help the Shona community.
We hope that they can be supported by both the national government and the county government, just in terms of affirmative action to catch up for the years of marginalization.
An estimated 1,300 Shona have yet to apply for citizenship, but those waiting for the certificate say they are ready to prove their worth.
We want to show that we are not just a burden to the country, but we are something else. We are birds with bright feathers. We are unworthy to be caged. That's what I would say. We now want to fly and showcase our bright feathers.
The UN's refugee agency says Kenya is home to about 18,000 stateless people, most of them ethnic minorities. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
And get
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Sally, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a man does not run among thorns for no reason. Either he is chasing a snake or a snake is chasing him. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.